Hello, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Joseph Esposito, the author of Dinner in Camelot, the night America's greatest scientists, writers, and scholars partied at the Kennedy White House. Joseph, thanks for being here with
me. Well, thank you, Rebecca. I'm delighted to be talking with you today.
So I'm hoping you can start out by talking a little bit about how you got interested in this topic and this night at the Kennedy White House, and share a little bit about how this book came to be.
Well, first, I met John Kennedy when I was a 10-year-old boy in October of 1960. I spoke with him, got his autograph on the cover of a Saturday Evening Post with a drawing of him by Norman Rockwell. And that really sparked a lifelong interest in for me in politics and government and history. And I eventually went on to serve in three presidential administrations. So that was certainly a factor. Another reason was that my wife's great-great-great-grandfather was James Hoban, who was the architect responsible for building the White House. So I had been interested in writing about the White House and about its history, and this was a vehicle for me to incorporate that. But most of all, I was absorbed by the story of the Nobel dinner, and this is an amazing story in and of itself. There was this fantastic collection of intellectuals, scientists, writers, scholars. There were 49 Nobel Prize winners honored that night, and many of the others who were there were equally as distinguished. So it was literally a who's who of American intellectuals at the mid-20th century. And in fact, in his remarks at the dinner, President Kennedy said that, "I think this is the most extraordinary collection of talent, of human knowledge, that has ever been gathered together at the White House, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone." Interestingly, that's what most people know about this dinner, but I thought there was much more to be said about the dinner. The lives of these people were intertwined, sometimes long before the dinner. The relationships were formed at the dinner, and old ones were renewed. And it was the start of other relationships that people at the dinner would have in subsequent years, in fact, going on for decades. And finally, and I think this is really important, it's not only an interesting story, but and a very fascinating glimpse into the past, it's really an opportunity to look back to observe when Washington, D.C. did work, when people of conflicting views could work together, they could socialize together, they could respect one another. The greatest example here is that Linus Pauling, a Nobel laureate, had written several strident letters to President Kennedy about a stalled nuclear test ban. He and his wife, Ava Helen Pauling, had picketed President Kennedy in front of the White House that day and the day before as well. And so in the mid-afternoon of Sunday, April 29th, 1962, they went over to the Willard Hotel, a couple of blocks from the White House, changed their clothes, and went to the White House for dinner. And President Kennedy, in the receiving line, said, "Dr. Pauling, how do you do? You've been around the White House a couple of days already, haven't you?" And then before introducing Pauling to Mrs. Kennedy, he added, "Dr. Pauling, I hope that you will continue to express your opinions." So thinking about that today, it's rather amazing. So those are some of the reasons why I became excited about researching and writing this book.
And so you start out, before you really get to the dinner, of sort of setting us up with what's going on in America at that time, right? America in Transition is your first chapter. And you talk a little bit about that and sort of where we're at in the Kennedy administration as well when you move in those first couple chapters. So can you talk a little bit about sort of setting the scene for this book and for this dinner?
Well, the intent, of course, as a writer here was to indeed set the scene so that there was a background to where we were. This is actually midpoint through the Kennedy administration, April of 1962. And the point was to look at all the issues, both foreign and domestic, that were confronting the Kennedy administration and how he had dealt with them. 1961 started out on a real high with the inauguration, but there were a lot of challenges, and the Kennedy administration, the Kennedy White House, had been working to grapple with some issues, and it really show their expertise. I mean, there was the Bay of Pigs fiasco. There were other challenges. 1962 was starting to become a little better, and there was a bit of a high experienced just a few weeks before the dinner, when John Glenn had orbited the Earth and had shown Americans prowess in the space race. And John Glenn was at the dinner. He was the hero of the hour. I thought it was important to discuss, to really provide a snapshot of America at the time of this dinner. And the vehicle that I used was the idea of going through the New York Times on a train ride from New York to Washington, D.C., which Diana and Lionel Trilling would have done.
And so you also talk a bit about the importance of Jacqueline Kennedy, and I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about her. So you talk about her role in the White House, her role, and you mentioned it earlier, your interest in sort of that architecture of the White House, but her sort of reviving and redecorating the White House and making the White House this sort of the space that it used to be, bringing it back to what it used to be. So can you talk a bit about Jacqueline Kennedy as a first lady, what you saw and her important role in sort of the White House and the sort of social atmosphere around the White House?
So much attention has been focused on Jacqueline Kennedy as a figure of glamour. And she certainly was that. And she captured the imagination of America. She was a young first lady, marked contrast to the previous first lady. And there were these events at the White House, dinners and performances. But she was also a person, I believe, of considerable depth in understanding art and art history and its importance of it to the country. On February 14th, 1962, roughly 2 months before this dinner, she did her famous tour of the White House, televised tour of the White House on CBS. And it was an unveiling of the refurbishing that she and her colleagues had undertaken over the past year. And it was widely acclaimed. She actually got an Emmy for it for the documentary. She established the Office of White House Curator. She established the Fine Arts Committee in the White House to research and basically cajole people into making donations of lost artifacts from the White House, furnishings and paintings. She had developed a handbook for the White House, and she also launched the White House Historical Association, which is still in operation and is quite vibrant. She wanted to make the White House a living museum, and I think that was an incredibly important contribution. She continued to have this interest in art and literature and art history after she left the White House. She later became a successful editor, book editor. She also was an influential person in helping to save Grand Central Station in New York from the wrecking ball. The idea of historic preservation was very important to her. I came away from the research here having a much deeper and greater appreciation for her contribution during those 1,000 days in the White House.
Right. And so before we start to talk a little bit more about some of the key figures that you really go in depth with at the dinner, I'm wondering if you can just sort of give an overview of the dinner itself, what the plan was for the dinner. You mentioned that, you know, it was the Nobel dinner and they brought in 47 Nobel, 49.
Well, there were 49 people honored, and George Marshall and Ernest Hemingway were honored posthumously. Their widows were there.
Right. So can you just sort of set the scene for that, and then we can talk about some of the more controversial people or some of the people who were at this dinner?
The White House staff had been engaged in a number of events there at the White House in the latter part of 1961, particularly. And there was an interest in broadening the participation from, say, the arts, purely the arts community. John Kennedy and his staff had, from the very outset, wanted to have the White House be a very welcoming place for the arts, broadly speaking, for artists, for people in the literary world. And they were invited to have a special position at the inauguration. Robert Frost, who was at this dinner, of course, gave a recitation of a poem at the inauguration. And it was decided that it was a good idea, it would be an excellent idea to also honor the scientists. And so most of these Nobel laureates were scientists. There were a few in peace, two Nobel Peace Prize winners, and there was Pearl Buck, who was a Nobel laureate in literature. But the bulk of these people were distinguished scientists in physics or chemistry or biology or medicine. And the idea developed in the fall of 1961, late fall, and it was worked on by Arthur Schlesinger, who was an aide there in the White House and a notable historian. And they put this dinner together and compiled various lists of literary figures, academics, scientists, and college presidents and other people to invite. And this was really an opportunity to pay tribute to a great sense of accomplishment for these Nobel Prize winners, for their contribution to their fields and to the United States, and also to be a sense of encouragement to young people as well, which President Kennedy mentioned in his remarks that night.
And so the dinner, as you said, brought in a number of different people. And so I'm wondering if you can talk, you highlight some of them. And one of them that you highlight is Oppenheimer and how, and the dinner's influence or the dinner's impact for him. So I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about having Oppenheimer at this dinner and what that meant and sort of his position at that time.
Oppenheimer was the father of the atomic bomb, and was the scientific head. Are we still here? Oh, okay. I'm sorry. My screen kind of went blank here. I'll just start that over. So I'll start now. Oppenheimer, of course, was the father of the atomic bomb, and he had been the scientific director at Los Alamos, and he was extraordinarily successful in the job that he was given. But he had become rather controversial, and he'd lost his security clearance in 1954. The question related to his prudence and perhaps even his loyalty. He was suspected of being soft on communism in the Soviet Union. And part of that was because he had opposed the development of a hydrogen bomb. So Kennedy's invitation that night represented the first part of his political redemption. But not everyone, of course, was pleased with that. One conservative Republican senator railed that Alger Hiss might follow Oppenheimer to the dinner. Oppenheimer had continued to work at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, but he had been removed from official Washington. And so it was a period of time when he was in the political wilderness. He did have friends, though, on the White House staff, and Dr. Glenn Seaborg, who was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, Arthur Schlesinger, and others. And they were interested in seeing what they considered a transgression addressed, and to help Oppenheimer get back in the good graces of official Washington. So this was essentially a two-step process for Oppenheimer. And he was definitely controversial. But the first step was inviting him to this dinner. And Oppenheimer is deeply appreciative of being invited. And later that year, actually it was in 1963, he had been selected for this prestigious Enrico Fermi Award that was presented by the president. And the actual award was going to be presented on November 22nd, 1963. And I think it was actually November 21st, 1963, but Kennedy was in Dallas. So they had delayed the presentation of the award. And of course, Kennedy died. And Lyndon Johnson wound up presenting the award in December. In 1963. But Oppenheimer never got his security clearance back. And in fact, at the dinner, the Nobel dinner, Glenn Seaborg asked him if he had been interested in trying to get his security clearance back and going through the process, having another hearing. And Oppenheimer emphatically said no. He was really done with that. But the idea that he would be honored, he had actually made a tremendous contribution to American science. This overture by the Kennedy White House was an opportunity to present Oppenheimer in a more realistic light.
Right. And so you have a couple of other scientists, and you mentioned Linus Pauling earlier, but I'm wondering if you can maybe expound a bit on Linus Pauling and the importance of him at the dinner. You mentioned that he and his wife were protesting earlier in the day, but can you talk a little bit more about him at that time and what was going on and why it was so important that he was there and being honored?
Well, Pauling was really a fascinating figure. And in fact, of all these people, all these guests at the dinner, most of them very distinguished, I found Pauling one of the two or three most interesting individuals to delve into, to research, and to write about. An extremely talented person. He had received the 1954 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. He was also nominated and almost got a Nobel Prize in medicine, and as a result of his social activism, he wound up getting a second Nobel Prize. He was the first American to be so honored with two Nobel Prizes, and they were in very different fields, chemistry and peace. Pauling was a very dedicated scientific researcher. His wife, Eva Helen Pauling, was a social activist, and she really encouraged him to get more engaged in this area. And in the 1940s and 1950s, he did so, and he was very much concerned about world peace. He was concerned about the prospect of atomic annihilation, and he was involved in a variety of initiatives to try to curb the use of nuclear weapons and reduce the prospect of war. He had become controversial as well. He had been investigated by the Senate, Senate Judiciary's Committee's Subcommittee on Internal Security. He had been investigated by the House Un-American Activities Committee. But he was a very steadfast individual. He was somewhat self-centered. He was self-righteous. In some instances, he could be difficult to get along with. But he had a certain sense of idealism, and he really stuck to it. He had seen potential in President Kennedy and actually supported him for president in 1960. But he had written a number of letters to him preceding the Nobel dinner. In one letter, he compared him to Hitler because he wasn't making sufficient progress in disarmament. But he could compartmentalize things too. He can go and picket and then go into the White House and have a good time. He said he thoroughly enjoyed himself. In fact, Pauling and Linus Pauling and Ava Helen Pauling led this impromptu spur of the moment dancing. Dancing wasn't anticipated that night, but they were in the hallway and they just started dancing, and a few other people joined in. Pauling was an interesting individual, and later on in life, he lived a very long life. He lived into his 90s. He had become a strong component of the value of vitamin C, and I think some people tend to remember him for that as well.
Right. So besides the scientists, there were also writers there. And so I'm wondering if you can talk, I think probably the most controversial writer that was there at that time and later was James Baldwin. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about James Baldwin and James Baldwin's role there and how then, and this is sort of a longer question, but I think you talk a bit about how James Baldwin played a role with Robert Kennedy as well, and Robert Kennedy's work with the civil rights movement and learning more about the civil rights movement. So can you talk a bit about James Baldwin?
James Baldwin was, along with Linus Pauling and Jacqueline Kennedy, I think the three most interesting figures at the dinner. There were many distinguished people, but they were the three people that I found the most fascinating for different reasons. James Baldwin had achieved a considerable amount of success in the 1950s. He had been an expatriate writer, but he had written a number of important books, and by the early 60s. He was starting to become more of a social activist. He met Robert Kennedy at the dinner that night, and that was one of those relationships that was particularly important as an outcome of the dinner. And a year later, Robert Kennedy, who was Attorney General, and Baldwin got together. First, they got together for a brief meeting at Robert Kennedy's house in McLean, Virginia, Hickory Hill. And they met for a short time because Baldwin's plane was delayed. But Kennedy said to him, "Can you assemble a group of African American leaders the next day at my apartment in New York City?" And they did, and it was a very interesting meeting that took place. Harry Belafonte was there, Lorraine Hansberry, Rip Torn, Dr. Kenneth Clark, a psychologist, was there. And it was a very, very contentious meeting. Robert Kennedy wanted to hear what the issues were related to African Americans. And to some extent, he was expecting to be praised for the work that he and his brother had done in the area of civil rights. But what he got was a considerable criticism and a certain sense of disappointment from the people who were assembled, and they talked about how really talked about discrimination, they talked about segregation, about civil rights, and about how much more work had been done. And Robert Kennedy took it as a personal affront, really. And after a meeting that lasted about 3 hours, he left unhappy. His guests left unhappy, and it was, as I say, a very contentious meeting. But it was also a very significant meeting because very quickly Robert Kennedy realized what they had been saying was in fact true, and something that he needed to process more. And his brother John Kennedy delivered his famous civil rights address only a few weeks later in June of 1963. And Robert Kennedy was the only one of his advisors who had encouraged him to do this civil rights address. Civil rights address was the vehicle where he laid out what eventually became the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So in the book, I talk about Baldwin, and it's a brief biographical sketch, and about his journey and his writings. And interestingly, and I think more people are coming to realize this, that James Baldwin's commentary was as valid and as insightful half a century ago as it is today. So I talk about Baldwin's writing, about his trip to the South, where he had grown up in Harlem, and he wasn't familiar with the South, and so he had become educated. He also had become educated about what was going on in the United States in the 1950s. Because he had lived abroad and really had been removed. So he had gotten an education about the racial tensions around the country. And so I talk about that. And I talk about this relationship that was formed between Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Baldwin. And that's another one of those interactions as a result of the dinner that made the dinner important, in addition to being a fascinating glimpse at this who's who of American intellectuals at the mid-century.
Right. So you also talk about the fact that this was not just they sat around and had dinner. There was a presentation and performance honoring Hemingway and George Marshall after. And so can you talk a little bit about that piece of it? Was it Frederick March who did the sort of performance of some of the pieces for something from the Marshall Plan, as well as some of Hemingway's work? And so why were these two honored, and what was that like at that night?
Well, it had been decided that there would be some after-dinner literary presentation, and so Frederick March had been invited to do the presentation. There was actually three people who were honored in that period. It was Sinclair Lewis. Very briefly, Sinclair Lewis was not a presence in any way at the dinner. George Marshall was. There was a brief a presentation of his commencement address at Harvard University, where he outlined the basics of the Marshall Plan. But the bulk of the literary presentation was an unpublished work by Ernest Hemingway, which eventually, I believe it was in 1970, was published as Islands in the Stream. Mary Welsh Hemingway, Ernest Hemingway's fourth and last wife, had some sort of interaction with the Kennedy White House. And that was after Ernest Hemingway had died, the Hemingway House in outside of Havana contained a lot of manuscripts and a lot of material, personal material. And Mary Hemingway and John Kennedy had a mutual friend, and that was William Walton. William Walton was an intermediary who helped Mary Hemingway get possessions out of Cuba once it became a Castro ruled country. And Mary Hemingway had been interested in meeting John Kennedy, and John Kennedy had been interested in meeting Mary Hemingway. So it had been decided that she would be at the dinner and that there would be the Hemingway presentation. John Kennedy had a great respect for Hemingway. They never met, but they corresponded a little bit. And at the outset of Profiles in Courage, John Kennedy, on his first page of the book, refers to Hemingway's definition of courage. John Kennedy considered himself a writer. They both were Pulitzer Prize winners. Of course, Kennedy was not a Nobel Prize winner. But it was a natural for Hemingway to be honored. So Tish Baldrige, the social secretary, had worked with Mary Hemingway, and it was very important because Mary Hemingway was the keeper of the flame, and this was part of her effort as the literary manager of her late husband to provide some additional manuscripts and to keep his name out there. Originally, they were going to do a production of what was The Killers, which would have been a really weird connection for the dinner, but they decided on this manuscript and she to be used, and she worked with Frederick March, and Frederick March by all accounts did a superb job. Was very nervous, but he did a fine job, and the reception for the Hemingway excerpt was not very well received. I mean, the reception was not very good. William Styron was one of those people who thought it was terrible, but others as well. So, interestingly, there were two people there at the dinner, and this is a commentary on the relationships that were, in some cases, hard to know. But there were two people at the dinner there who had unfortunate relationships with Ernest Hemingway, who was in some ways especially honored at the dinner. Catherine Ann Porter, whose book, A Ship of Fools, hit the New York Times bestseller list at number one that day for the first time. Catherine Ann Porter and Ernest Hemingway met once, and that was at Sylvia Beach's bookshop in Paris, Shakespeare and Company. And Sylvia Beach said to, they were both in the room together, and Sylvia Beach said, "I'd like the two great young writers to meet one another." And Hemingway, being Hemingway, was very upset that he would be put in the same category as this unknown Catherine Ann Porter, and he got very angry and he stomped out. And that was the end of their brief. The brief relationship. John Dos Passos and Ernest Hemingway had been great friends for a while. They had became acquainted during World War I. And they had a falling out, a serious falling out, as a result of the Spanish-American, or sorry, not the Spanish-American War, but the Spanish Civil War. And for other personal reasons. And so there was a very bitter break in their relationship. And he had Hemingway sent a very unpleasant letter to Dos Passos, basically saying, "I don't want to deal with somebody like you anymore." So there were two people who had rather rocky relationships with Ernest Hemingway there, and two notable writers, Catherine Ann Porter and John Dos Passos.
All right. So you talk a bit about the presentation, and then you talk about this after party that went on, that a select few sort of came to. And I think that relates back to how you talk about, and then you go on to talk about how their lives sort of become connected. So I'm wondering if you can just talk a bit about this after party and how this after party set up relationships as well that went on well past this dinner.
Well, about a dozen people were invited up to the White House residence, the Yellow Oval Room, which was a place of refuge both for Jackie Kennedy and for John Kennedy. And this was the part of the evening where Jackie Kennedy could basically relax and not be really in the public eye. And so Robert Frost was there, Lionel and Diana Trilling were there, and Rose and Bill Styron were there, and several others. And we get a lot of, I was fortunate to be able to interview Rose Styron, who also did the foreword for the book. And she provided a lot of information about that event, about that aspect of the evening. And William Styron himself wrote about it. And it was a short period of time, perhaps an hour. They smoked cigars, they talked, it was a matter of people relaxing and getting acquainted. Robert Frost was kind of a real magnet for people there. He was a magnet for people throughout the evening, because he was, of course, although an octogenarian, he was a very distinguished poet and somebody who was widely respected. Some additional people came who hadn't been at the dinner. Sergeant Shriver was there, who was not at the dinner. Two of President Kennedy's sisters were there. And they relaxed and they talked, and they talked about literature, and they talked about sailing. And it was where the idea of the Styrons sailing with the Kennedys took place for the first time. And shortly after that, they did go sailing that summer. And it was the start of a 50-year-plus friendship between the Kennedy family and the Styron family. A lot of funny stories associated with the dinner, and many of those were conveyed by William Styron in his letters or in an article he wrote called Havanas and Camelot, and also by Diana Trilling, the literary critic, who wrote an article that was published posthumously in the New Yorker in the 1990s. And initially, neither the Trillings nor the Styrons, who were first the first people to enter the Yellow Oval Room, knew exactly why they were there. and they waited, and eventually the president came. But before the president came, William Styron sat in the president's rocking chair, and he had to be cajoled by Arthur Schlesinger to leave the rocking chair because the president had entered the room. But there's some funny stories about it, and I talk about it in the book. And Styron had been taking an antibiotic, and he also wound up having some drinks. So he was, by his own admission, was a little lightheaded. And some of his remarks were rather caustic, but also quite humorous.
And so, you wrap up the book, and you mentioned this sort of at the beginning of the interview, but you wrap up the book in why this dinner is so important right now, right? And why it's really important in your epilogue, what we need to, those lessons that we learned. So I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that in sort of a wrap up to this book and why this dinner at the Kennedy White House, this one dinner was so important and is so important to us to sort of think about now as well and the role of this dinner. If there's anything, last things you want to add.
I think one of the most important things is that we need to remember the importance of really honoring our scientists, our writers, our intellectuals. There's a certain sense of intellectualism today in the United States, I think. And these people who were at the Nobel dinner made incredible contributions to this country. And in some cases, they were immigrants fleeing repressive regimes. And they made contributions in physics, chemistry, and biology, and medicine. It's just a staggering a contribution to American society and to the world. And so I think there is an important argument to be made that we need to have this respect and admiration and for people who have achieved so much, not only for what they have achieved, which is important, but also for encouragement for young people. And I think President Kennedy understood that. And certainly I would chime in on this whole issue of polarization in America. I think that this dinner shows that there were people there who actually disagreed with President Kennedy, people who questioned his judgment on certain things. But there was a sense of common purpose too, and that the idea of being at the White House and interacting and to having a dialogue and to be conciliatory was something that was very important. And I think that there is a certain kind of what I might call a Nobel spirit that this country could rally back to.
The book just came. It just came out, correct?
The official publication,
or is it
is April 3rd?
Okay, so tomorrow is the official publication date. So you probably are not working on anything else, but I don't know if there are. Is there anything that you have coming up soon that you wanted to promote, or if you do have a new project you are already working on? Is there any sort of last things you want to promote before we finish up?
Well, I'm rather busy promoting this book.
You're right. I figured.
So we have I have a very full radio schedule this week, and a national a book tour. I'm going to be in San Francisco and Boston and Cape Cod and Washington and Richmond and Princeton and talking about different aspects of the book. Sometimes about Kennedy, sometimes about Oppenheimer. And other people, Pearl Buck. So I'm spending a lot of time on that. But I became so immersed in this issue of this story about Robert Kennedy and James Baldwin that I'm working on that as my next book, Robert Kennedy, James Baldwin, and the Acrimonious Meeting That Changed the Course of Civil Rights.
Right. Interesting. Well, it's been really wonderful talking to you. It was really great to read about sort of this. And I agree, like this one time where intellectualism wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't a dirty word, right?
Yes.
And so I want to thank you for talking with me again. This was Joseph Esposito, the author of Dinner in Camelot, The Night America's Greatest Scientists, Writers, and Scholars Party at the Kennedy White House. Joseph, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you, Rebecca. I enjoyed it.